Good afternoon, Bay Area. Welcome to the very first episode of the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton, where every week we tap into the Bay Area art scene and bring you rich conversations with artists. I'm your host, Janae Darton. On today's show, poet Allie Jones chats with me about honoring her Creole heritage in her new book. Then we'll hear from a theater company that presents plays from women and gender non-conforming artists over 40, and a drag parody of the 90s sitcom, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Poetry, plays, and parody, that's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. For me, the studio is like my living room. I treat guests as if we're sitting on the couch or chatting with a cup of tea or drinking something a little stronger. You know what I mean? Speaking of drinks, let's talk about poet Allie Jones's book. It's called Saltwater Moonshine. Allie's Creole heritage, her memories of East Palo Alto, and Black womanhood all inspired her book. Allie is also the co-founder of Black Freighter Press. And she's the new host of Creative Mornings Oakland chapter. Creative Mornings is a global organization that hosts conversations with people making a difference in their communities. And I've given a talk there before. And they have an event coming up this Friday. But in this interview, Allie and I chat about her poetry that takes readers from the bayou to the bay. Allie Jones, my first guest for my show.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Allie, you do so much in the community, especially the literary community. If they ever put booked and busy in the dictionary, your face would be there because you do so much. But I want to talk about you being a writer. Who or what inspired you to write?
Ooh, me as a writer. So I grew up with, poets like Maya Angelou and Sakya Shange and Sonia Sanchez. But my mom was actually a self-published writer, and seeing her put together the stories of my grandma and my great aunt was just really inspirational. And so when I thought about my own journey, I just knew it was possible.
Aside from being a writer, a publisher, and host of Creative Mornings in Oakland and so many other things, I noticed in your bio of your book, you said you are a Creole mermaid. Mm-hmm. I said, I wish you got time to be swimming.
The irony is that I actually don't know how to swim. Don't tell nobody.
don't tell nobody to all those
right, listeners. To all the listeners of your amazing show. So Creole mermaid came really to me from like my affinity to mermaids, my affinity to the water. I was born by the water. Pisces, shout out to Pisces season. And I really wanted to reclaim my Creole identity. I think that when my family moved to California, there was a lot of assimilation and we just became Black. And there's nothing wrong with us being Black, but there's a really beautiful space of us being Creole. And so I wanted to call that back into every space that I'm in for folks to be like, well, what does that mean? What is that? Are you Haitian? And I'd be like, no, maybe somewhere along the lines, but Louisiana Creole is a very specific blend of African and Native American and French and Spanish. It's a bunch of different folks together. And so I think about that kind of like jambalaya, like gumbo, right? Like all of these different worlds coming together in a beautiful way, even when there was struggle and when there is struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I appreciate Creole food.
Mm-hmm.
And when you have good Creole food, you could feel the love that's in that food.
You have to.
Yeah. You definitely do. And I feel a lot of love in your book, Saltwater Moonshine. And I love that title. I love that title, Saltwater Moonshine. There's so much in that title. Talk about the title. What inspired you to name the book Saltwater Moonshine?
So initially the title was Starshine and Clay, inspired by Lucille Clifton's Won't You Celebrate With Me, was one of the lines. And then I found out that Aisha Camila Moon actually had a book called Starshine and Clay. And I was like, oh no, I have to respect this ancestor and their work and I got to do a shift. And so I just thought about how I was paying tribute to, you know, the bayou to the bay, like thinking about water. I was like, how do I bring in the water, and I'm not just calling it the ocean book, right? So I thought about the salt water of tears, the salt water of, again, the bayou, the ocean, the bay. And then moonshine is just part of like I still wanted to bring the moon. I still wanted to bring the shine in. And so I was like, ooh, this is kind of also a nod to the South and the way that folks were creating and like resisting during Prohibition in different ways. And I think about like this time of books, you know, we're in a sort of prohibition around books too. And so I wanted to think about that in a more dynamic way.
There's so many themes in the book, just like even just in the title alone, right? So many things come up. One of my favorite themes definitely is Black womanhood and memory.
Mm-hmm.
And you were telling me earlier before we started the interview that the book speaks in the voices of you and your mother and your grandmother. Mm-hmm. And I love there's a line in one of your poems where you say, like, you carry memory in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
So talk about that as far as, this, you know, this idea of memory and Black womanhood in your poetry.
Yeah, absolutely. Poetry was and is a space that I've been processing a lot of different grief. And so when I first started even writing, my grandma was dying. And in the process of dying, she was also going through Alzheimer's, and she was forgetting everything from her amazing, you know, recipes to who we were. And that grief was like heartbreaking. And so what I sat with was like, where do our memories live, and how do they live on, and what do they look like? And I was telling a friend recently, like, I visited my grandma in hospice, and she saw me, and it was the first time in years she actually saw me and looked like she knew who I was immediately. And she grabbed my hand, and I thought about how like that connection of our hands was like, our memories live there. Our memories are not just in our mind. They're in so many different places. And so, you know, the space to be able to be present with people. Like, I just sat with her holding her hand, right? And I think that when I'm writing, that kind of vehicle, that kind of space to explore topics that were really hard. Grief is hard. Death is hard, right? I wanted to think about, like, not just the pain of it, but also the joy, also the laughter. And like you said, the good food, like there is so much love there that I can't forget while she's forgetting. Right. And so, you know, we're in this age where we become the memory keepers, right? The culture bearers, the folks who propel the things that our families have carried. And again, not just the bad stuff, but everything. So we know that we're multifaceted, that we are, you know, complex, that we have these deep, rich histories.
You know, the same thing happened to me and my grandmother. She's from Mississippi. She was from Mississippi, and she had dementia. Mm-hmm. So I know your pain of watching an elder, you know, lose their memory. And towards the end of her life, she saw me. She didn't forget who I was, but she just forgot a lot of things.
Mm-hmm.
But towards the end of her life, it seemed like she had just snapped out of it, the dementia. And she grabbed my hand and held my hand too.
Mm.
And yeah, mm-hmm. And then she died a few weeks later.
Yeah.
And dementia is interesting because I think the heart doesn't forget.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a similar thing happened. I went to open mic where I wrote a poem about her. And 7 days later, she passed away.
Those grandmas from the South.
Okay.
And, mm-hmm. Okay, so you grew up in Fresno, but this book pays homage to Louisiana and East Palo Alto. So your grandmother lived in East Palo Alto? Yes. That's where she migrated?
Yeah, so my family migrated to East Palo Alto in the 60s. It's where I spent my summers and vacations and Christmas. And so when I think about this part of the Bay Area, which now is known for tech, now is known for being in the Silicon Valley, I think about Black people first. And not a lot of people do. And so I wanted to pay homage to that space because it's part of what raised me. It's part of how I came to be who I am, even if I didn't live there.
And I'm glad that you talk about East Palo Alto, because I don't think when we talk about the Bay Area, East Palo Alto gets enough attention because there's so much history and culture there. And also, too, there's a language.
Mm-hmm.
We see the intersections of French and English,
mm-hmm.
What made you decide to do that? Aside from just, I know, you know, you think of Creole, French, but to put those languages in there.
Yeah, so it's kind of the reclamation around like the Creole mermaid, like my family assimilating into California. Like my mom, her first language was Creole. And when she moved to California, she had to learn English. And in that, there's an erasure that happens. So by the time my generation comes, they're speaking Creole, but they're not teaching it. And I go to my little family parties and everybody, like we're speaking French. Like everybody is in there gossiping and, you know, doing all the things in French. And so I was nosy. I wanted to know what they were saying. And so I learned French. And for me, writing these pieces in a blend or where you, if you know, you know, like I wanted to speak to like my grandma and my great aunt and my folks who had to sacrifice pieces of themselves to be somewhere where now it's like a luxury to be able to say, I speak three languages, right? Creole and French are not too far off. Louisiana Creole, like phonetically, is very French. Mm-hmm. That's a dialect, it's not written anywhere. And so when we do see it written, that's just like different scholars who have kind of gone through. I did get like an Afro-Creole poetry anthology. And that was interesting because it went back into like the 1800s, 1900s of like pieces that were published in a newspaper. And I think in that, I just was inspired to think about how language and culture is pushed through writing, through poetry, through so many different things.
Well, we've been talking about this book. Can you read a little piece for the folks out there?
Yes, yes, yes. And I think this piece is going to move with it.
I have my book, so I want to follow along. What page are you on?
42. Yeah. When a sparrow cries, a soul flies silently. In the greenest pastures covered by warm rays beaming, sous le soleil, hummingbirds stand still in observance, in reverence for the stars who no longer burn, with the light that never fades. Avec une lumière qui brille, generational grief in my bones, hope that frays, dismembered, memory, unspoken knowing in my hair. We say so much more, shouting wild, vision blurred, in a matrix, assimilations tilting, artifacts shrill of sacrifice, cloudy countenance, regret creeps out your eardrum steady and resounding, white noise tingles straight to the temporal lobe. I hope you dance and sing les chansons de joie et d'amour profonde. Pas de souci, pas de larmes, rien qu'une souris qui allume. J'espère que tout va bien, même si vous savez pas comment.
That is so beautiful. Thank you for that.
Yeah, that was a piece I actually wrote in honor of a French teacher I had who passed away. The shock of it, I was like, you know what? There was a lot of joy in our connection. And so the end of it says, it's like, I hope you dance, I hope you sing. And then like giving a little translation, the songs of joy and profound love, no worries, no tears, just a smile that brightens. I hope that everything goes well, even when you don't know how it will.
What a beautiful tribute. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, your book, it feels like water when I read it. I feel like I'm on a wave, like I'm floating on a wave. And it'll, you know, and a gentle wave that'll maybe push me up and then, you know, I kind of go back down again. That's just how it feels. It feels like a ride, a gentle ride. And I love that you have art in here. And it's watercolor art, which fits because water is so prominent in this book. And the artwork is by Marissa Arterberry. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, the work is just gorgeous. So I just definitely want to mention her as well. Mm-hmm. So again, you're always uplifting artists. So it's not a total shock that you are the new host of Creative Mornings Oakland. Which is a big deal. When I heard you were doing that, I was like, wow, I was like, that's actually perfect for her. And I don't know how Allie Jones does it, because Allie Jones has so many other things going on. And so what can people expect for your Friday, March 14th event?
So Friday, March 14th, our theme is parallel. And our speaker is Luca Yacon, and they are a queer, trans, indigenous person of color in the Bay. They are the founder of Radically Fit, which is a gym in East Oakland. But it's not just a gym. They do so much there, you know, whether it's like fighting for the Palestinian freedom struggle, right? Like really holding space to thinking about fat bodies, thinking about Black and brown bodies, disabled bodies, folks who are moving through things that they don't always talk about. And so I'm really excited to have them come through. The format's gonna be a little different than our usual creative mornings, usually talk. Luca and I are gonna be like in a discussion.
Oh, that'd be cool. Yeah, I definitely encourage people to go. I love creative mornings, so I'm glad you all are back. And again, to echo what you said, it is a great place to meet people and to network. I remember somebody came up to me and they said they met their partner because okay. My creative warnings talks. So every time they see me, they think about how they fell in love. So, you know,
there was a proposal. There was a proposal at one of the talks. It was like the commitment talk, and the videographers like got engaged.
Oh wow! Oh wow! So yeah, we can't guarantee matrimony, but but you will have a good time. Allie, congratulations. The book is gorgeous. It's beautiful. I'm so happy it's out in the world. And I'm so happy that you are my first guest. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Allie Jones' book is Saltwater Moonshine. You can order it from her website, alliejones.com. And check out the next Creative Mornings event in Oakland on Friday, March 14th at Ground Floor. We'll have links to all of this information on klw.org's Sights and Sounds page. And coming up, don't turn that dial or click away. Playwright Victoria Irville is here to talk about her show, Telling Tales and Rolling Eyes. Drama. We'll be back. Welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. In the theater world, there's gender bias and age bias when it comes to playwrights getting their work on stage. But Three Girls Theater knows that an artist can still be fabulous at age 40 and up. The theater company presents plays by women and non-gender conforming artists who are over 40. KALW has partnered with Three Girls Theater during their New Works Festival, and we've been showcasing these plays at our downtown San Francisco venue. The festival wraps up this week, and I'm here with playwright and director Victoria Irville, whose upcoming show is called Tale and Tales and Rolling Eyes. Hey, Victoria.
Hey.
How are you?
I'm wonderful. Thank you.
Good, good, good. I've been looking at your bio, and Victoria, you've been involved with the African American Shakespeare Company, the Lorraine Hansberry Theater, Marin Shakespeare Company, and the list is so long. You're so embedded in the theater culture here. Who ignited your passion for plays?
I think I just have always been creative. I started writing when I was a little kid. I think my first play I wrote when I was 12. It was a musical, even though I didn't play music in any way. But from that point on, I just have always been interested in the arts and in writing specifically. Mm-hmm. I'm a good eavesdropper, so I'm always listening okay. to other people's conversations, and that probably doesn't hurt. And then as I was writing, I was realizing that maybe I needed more experience in the arts. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to be an actor. I studied for acting. And then once I was doing that, I thought, well, maybe I should try directing. Okay. And then I became producing. And then I started teaching. And it just has all been one fun soup of activity.
Nice. Nice to be in all that imagination and creativity. And yeah, that sounds like so much fun. Yeah. And I know, too, and a lot of work, too, as well. Tell us about Three Girls Theater and your involvement.
Well, I got involved with Three Girls about 4 years ago. I submitted a play. They are this wonderful organization that supports women plus that are over the age of 40. Ageism exists in the arts just like it exists everywhere else. Mm-hmm. And it's hard as a woman just to get produced. And their organization focuses on supporting new playwrights who are over the age of 40 and are identify as women plus.
Okay, which is so needed, you know, because like you said, because of the ageism. And
right, I mean, less than 3% of all plays produced are produced by women.
Wow, okay.
Especially women of color.
Okay, wow, wow. And it's and that's interesting you say that because I was looking up about who attends plays, and I read different articles, and I saw anywhere between like 60 to 70% of plays, the audience is usually women.
Yeah, exactly. But they're not the ones who pick the productions, right?
Right.
So there's a literary manager in most theater companies who is producing and picking the plays that are written. Mm-hmm. And there was a survey done a few years ago where the same play was presented and they put the author's name as a male identifying name and then they sent it again as a female identifying name and the person always picked the male identifying play even though they were
it was the same thing.
Exactly.
Wow.
I don't know why. But yeah.
Wow. 2025 and we're still dealing with that. Mm. Yeah. Mm. Well, we did that. Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk. Speaking of which, I think that goes with the title of your play, which
exactly.
is Telling Tales and Rolling Eyes. And when I saw that title, I said, that sounds like somebody being messy and they dramatic and lying.
Well, that's the whole story is basically of a producer who is gatekeeping the types of shows that are produced on their stage. And two black playwrights question that and they decide, hey, you know, we've had enough. You know, our stories are just as important. And within that, they talk about what is a black play and what kind of plays do we write or who gets to tell our stories
yeah.
and what stories are we telling. And so so there's a little comedy in there. And a little drama and a little rolling of eyes, but it's all about what tale do we tell?
Yeah, and I know, yeah, I saw a little clip of it, and I noticed that the character was being criticized because they like Shakespeare, and you know, they're like Shakespeare's not black, and you know, and all that kind of stuff.
But, right, exactly, and it's just like when black writers, and for myself at least, we have this idea that okay, well, what is a black story? So one of the characters says, well. You can't do the Black History Month play because Black History Month plays are basically August Wilson, right? Or a dead playwright.
Right.
And that say, well, wait a minute, you know, I want to tell that story.
Right.
And it could be a love story. It doesn't have to be about slavery or you know, some of the more tragic and negative aspects. But black culture is so beautiful that why aren't we telling those stories?
Yeah. So I'm getting the feeling that this play is inspired maybe by some of your experiences because you're kind of taking us behind the scenes of what can happen to playwrights of color, or just playwrights, you know, in marginalized communities when they're trying to get their work on stage.
Right, and there definitely has that feeling, like when you look at a lot of the plays that are produced and written by black playwrights, that they have a certain kind of a theme, and you're not seeing too many sci-fi plays written out, you know, produced out there. I'm guessing that they're written. They're
right.
just not being chosen. So it's all about who chooses
right.
our story. It's not even so much about who the writer is, but what is the director doing? What director is choosing what stories to tell? And those stories are, you know, if you live someplace where maybe there's not a lot of black people and your only exposure is what you see in the arts and you're only seeing that one play,
right,
and that's what you're basing your experience on, of who we are. And so shouldn't we have a more varied idea of that, of
right.
who we are? Because we are varied. And you know, we all have our different loves and likes, and we're no different than other people in that same way. We raise our children, we go to the grocery store, we have our marital arguments and all of that.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's so many stories and you know, to tell and just to show the human experience, you know, from different vantage points. And what I love is that these are staged readings.
Right.
I love staged readings because my imagination just gets busy. I guess maybe it's kind of like radio because you know, people have sound effects. I love staged readings. And even though people aren't in costume or they might be, I can still just see it as a play. So what is it like for you as far as, like, I guess you're directing this too as well? Or?
No. Kat Brooks, who's a wonderful director.
Kat Brooks is a good director.
Oh, my goodness. Yes, she is. And
yeah.
I'm blessed to have her. And then Kathleen Ridley is also, she's a super talented actress, but she was the dramaturg on this show.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually the role of a person who kind of slaps you on your hand and says, that's not working.
Okay. So
So she did that for me. And I love stage readings as well,
yeah,
because plays change and they evolve. And mm-hmm. it's so nice to have it read and acted in front of an audience. And you, as the playwright, get a sense of what's working, what's yeah. not working. And then you can get that talk back from the audience about what they liked,
yeah.
what they questioned, you know, oh, that doesn't make sense, or that did make sense, or I appreciated what you just said there, or mm-hmm. I connected with that character in a way, and so you can kind of move forward. I mean, this play is in version 15.2.
So, oh, wow.
that's what happens.
The draft.
That's how it works. That's right. That's how it works.
I want to mention, too, that these performances for this festival are very generously priced. The ticket prices are on a sliding scale starting at $15, or you can pay what you can at the door. And I know, you know, right now times are tough. Money is tight for a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm. And they never turn anyone away.
And they never turn anyone mm-hmm. away. So for folks maybe who've been missing the theater and they don't have access, this is very generous pricing. And a lot of your work pertains to Shakespeare, just reading your background. And again, Shakespeare comes up in this play. What is it about Shakespeare that, because you teach Shakespeare, what's the draw to Shakespeare for you?
I liked Shakespeare a lot. Just the stories are so relatable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mothers wanting their children, the best for their children, people falling in love, people being hurt by others, yeah. family. Shakespeare has a lot to offer. I mean, there are other playwrights, and that is mentioned in my play, mm-hmm. Telling Tales and Rolling Eyes, that sometimes we depend too much on Shakespeare.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of theater companies do Shakespeare because he's free, he's dead. You know, you can mm-hmm. you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Oh, I see. Know? Yeah.
So uh-huh. that royalty issue.
Right.
Comes
that's what
in.
I was thinking. Yeah.
You know,
mm-hmm.
So, but there are also writers from other cultures that we don't explore that have stories to tell as
mm-hmm.
well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the play that in Rolling Eyes, Telling Tales that we talk about is just that, why aren't we seeing more Lorraine Hansberry shows?
Yeah.
You know, why aren't we seeing, I mean, yes, we see August Wilson, but there are so many other writers out there
mm-hmm.
that we could be experiencing, and they have such important stories to tell.
Yeah. It's funny because you mentioned sci-fi, and I love sci-fi. And I
like Octavia Butler.
Yeah, like,
right.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. I forgot, what's her name? Was it Tori Regan? She did a production of Parables.
Mm-hmm.
The woman, her mother was in Sweet Honey in the Rock. Her name escapes me. But yeah, she did a production of Parables of the Sower, like, on stage. I mean,
yeah. Yeah, they did something at, what, Zellerbach, I think, a year
ago. Oh, yeah, yeah, because it toured a little bit, too, mm-hmm. as well. Yeah, and then I saw a play, too, with my producer, Prefer Rung. He saw it, too, as well. It was on Japanese Americans and about the stigma against MSG, and they used like inspired by like video games, and they used, it was surrealism. It was really, really cool, and it's a neat way to tell a story. So there's all different types of things you can do, and I saw this at the San Francisco Playhouse. There's mm-hmm. all different types of ways to tell stories now.
Oh, yeah, and just to open people's eyes up to a different experience. You know, it's that whole idea of just like living in someone else's shoes. You're
right.
sitting safely in a theater seat, but you're experiencing something, and you're looking at someone else's lives, and you're saying, you know, I can understand that. I can relate to that.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the best thing to do is to evoke a conversation. I mean, that's what I always hope when I write a play mm-hmm. is that it sparks conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Well, definitely this, because like I think as creatives, we can relate to just dealing with the gatekeeper, and then to as I'm thinking too, as even as a Black artist, like having that question, like, is my art Black enough? And
mm-hmm.
and even that struggle of like, is my art too Black, and worrying about, am I going to turn away audiences? But then at the same time, I want to like honor my culture. And I know I've talked to other artists from other different backgrounds, and they deal all with this too as well.
Yeah, it's the idea of like, who are you writing for?
Right, right. And it's a big world out there, so
mm-hmm,
it's like
mm-hmm.
you can't reach everybody, you know,
yeah,
you can't
right,
satisfy
right.
everybody.
Right. I think you just have to tell the story that's in your heart, you know, what you mm-hmm. feel. I mean, sometimes you just write for yourself, and if you're honest about that, then you'll find your audience.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Good advice, good advice. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you, too, before we wrap up, so many theater companies have closed in the Bay Area, and it's just breaking my heart, because when I think of the Bay, the first thing I think of is the arts. I mean, we have such a beautiful, rich art community. I know I have friends who are artists. They can't afford to live here. They've been pushed out.
Yes.
What's your hope for the future of theater in the Bay Area?
I think that we're going to rebound. I mean, I'm just being really hopeful.
Yeah.
But I believe it because the arts are who we are.
Yeah.
And we have to find new ways. Yes, we're struggling. There's mm-hmm. a lot of theater companies, big and little, that mm-hmm. have struggled and have closed.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to see, I think more and more companies are going to have to become collaborative with
yeah.
each other,
yeah.
share more resources, and find ways. But what I'm hoping that they don't do is just say, well, we can only tell the old stories because they're safe.
Mm.
And we don't take the chance on a new writer
yeah.
because we don't. That person's not known. Their name's not known. Maybe nobody will come see them. They still have to take those risks because that's what makes theater and art so special, is we're taking those risks.
Yeah.
But I believe in the theater and in the Bay Area, and it's such a tight community. Everybody knows each other or knows of each other,
mm-hmm.
and I'd like to believe that we're all super supportive of each other,
yeah,
and that we all want the best for each other. Maybe we stagger opening nights a little bit more
mm-hmm.
so that everybody has an opportunity to have some of those same audience members mm-hmm. come, as opposed to always having to pick, well, four shows are opening on the 14th, so mm-hmm. which one do I pick?
Yeah, well, yeah.
Maybe if we figure out a way to stagger those dates, that might be what could make it so that people can go to two or three of those shows.
Yeah.
Maybe we do group subscriptions. So it's not just subscribing to my theater company, but my subscription mm-hmm. is going to let me go, just like the museums where you can go to multiple museums.
Right.
Maybe you can go to multiple theater companies. I don't know. I mean, I'm just talking, you know.
Hey, you got a dream. That's where it starts. Just a few more seconds. Last thoughts. Tell us why we should go see your show on Sunday.
It is fun. It is fun to get out and meet new people and to see a new play that is in progress and to be a part of that, because I will be there. We're going to have a party afterwards. Come and see me. Come talk to me. Tell me what your thoughts are. They might end up on the page.
Uh-oh.
So, hey. You know.
All right, y'all. So you actually get to talk to the artist, the creator. Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Make sure to catch Victoria Irvo's play, Telling Tales and Rolling Eyes, this Sunday, March 16th, 2 p.m. at KLW's venue in downtown San Francisco. And we're at 220 Montgomery. KLW is showcasing Three Girls Theater Productions this Thursday through Sunday. And you can go to klw.org/events for ticket info. And coming up, the director of the drag parody, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, live. Keep it locked right here. All right, welcome back to the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darden. We've gone to the Bayou, the Bay, and now Bel-Air. The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is definitely a favorite for many who love 90s sitcoms, and the show has gone through a few iterations, a comedy, a drama series on Peacock, and here in San Francisco, of course, a drag parody. This is the last week you can see The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air live at Oasis. Snacks is a drag queen, COO of Oasis, and the show's director, and she's here to tell us more, and I gotta say her name with some toot. Hey, Snacks!
Hey, how's it going? Thank you for having me, and congrats on your first episode.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
Thank you. And congratulations on this show, an all-black drag parody. And Oasis has done, you know, parody of other shows. So, Snacks, why The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
Well, two big reasons. One, selfishly, I love the show. I watched Fresh Prince so much growing up, and that show is so funny, and I still love to watch it. And so I was excited to bring that material to the stage. But also, you know, Oasis has a really long history of doing drag parodies of TV shows like Sex and City, mm-hmm. Star Trek, Friends, you know, a lot of these shows that have a lot of all white casts.
Right.
And the reality is, like, a lot of TV sitcoms from the past are all white. And it was really important to me to bring some diversity to the stage and bring something that was a different experience and a different lived experience. And it's been really rewarding because not only am I giving a platform to a ton of very, very talented Black artists to perform, but I'm also bringing something that resonates with a different generation and a different mm-hmm. you know, demographic of people that otherwise don't get to see themselves represented that much on stage.
And definitely The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is one of my favorite shows growing up. What did this show mean to you when you watched it?
I mean, I think The Fresh Prince is a really unique show in the sense that it did a lot of different types of material successfully. Like, not only is it a funny show and a musical show, but it also covered a lot of really serious things. Like, you know, I think about the episode with Will's dad, and I think about the episode with, you know, Carlton getting a gun and doing speed. And, you know, a lot of those kind of, what do they call it? Like after school specials that you'd see, but wrapped in a way that felt really engaging and felt really exciting to watch and honest, you know? And we definitely, I would say, like, you know, our Oasis version is, of course, you know, even more ridiculous, even more music, even more dancing, even some drag lip syncs in it, some slow-mo fight scenes. Like, there's all kinds of craziness in it. But it really does have a heart. And I think that's the thing that I really wanted to translate from the original show, is the heart that all of these characters had.
You know, for me, it was, first of all, just to see Will Smith, who's, you know, a rapper, and to see like a rapper with a sitcom was such a big deal. And so to see hip hop on that television, you know, platform, if you will. And then I'm also, too, just thinking about the class differences, you know, the Fresh Prince. I mean, because he was from Philly, from the hood, coming to Bel-Air. So you saw different types of black families. And of course, it was just hilarious. So
absolutely. And that's the thing, right? Will Smith was cool. Like, watching him, he's just like, he's got the moves, he's got the swag, he's got all the right things to say. Like, and our actor that plays Will, Major Hammy, is a drag king, and they are so charismatic on stage and have so much swag and are such a good mover and dancer. And so it's been really like such a perfect casting for them to be in the show. But yeah, I agree with you in the sense that that's another beautiful thing about Fresh Prince is, like, you know, it's categorized as a black show, but it's there's not one type of black family,
right?
And there's not one type of black experience, you know? And so it's cool to have all of these different characters that have all these different lived experiences and different points of view and perspectives, and be able to showcase that, you know?
Yeah. And what's the, I feel like, you know, what's the cultural significance of a production when artists want to do it in drag? Like, what does that say about a show when people want to do it in drag?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, like, it means in some ways that it's timeless, right? Like, there's a relationship that people can have to those characters even 30 years later, and a relationship that people can have to the material that much later, that it is ongoing. And I think, you know, TV shows become syndicated when they just air forever on different platforms and different channels and stuff. And the shows that are able to do that are the ones that still matter to people and still mean something. And so I think, like, one of the things that I really want to emphasize with Fresh Prince and really with all the shows we do at Oasis is, like, you don't really have to know the source material. Like, we make our shows very accessible to people, and the shows are funny and they're silly and they're fun to watch and there's drag. And, you know, it's for the people that know, there's always some good Easter eggs in there. And, like, again, as someone who knows the show really well, we make sure we throw in all the stuff, the jazz toss, the Carlton dance, like, all of it's in there. But even if you don't know the show, you can still come in, like, completely blind to the material and have a good time.
Yeah, you do the jazz toss? Y'all throw some?
Yeah, of course. We have a recording of it, a video of it. And we redid the opening credits. It's shot for shot the same. And so it's really fun when the show starts and everyone's singing along to the theme song because, you know, that's... everyone's got that burned in their brains, like, no matter how old you are.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. For those who don't know, who didn't watch the show, the jazz toss is when Fresh Prince's friend, DJ Jazzy Jeff, he would always say something, and he would get put out the house, and they would just throw him. And, like, he would go flying across the lawn. Hilarious.
Exactly.
Yes, hilarious, hilarious. What is it like for you as a director working on this?
This show is my baby. It's the first show that I ever directed here at Oasis 2 years ago, and then I got a chance to direct it again. And so it's been really special because I've got to grow with this show. We have a lot of the same cast that we had 2 years ago, and so all of those actors have gotten to really grow with their characters, too, and even find more, you know, parallels between their own lives and their characters. And for me, like, a lot of it was confidence, honestly. Like, you know, I've listened to the other speakers, and I think we all have a through line of the fact that, you know, Representation matters, and women being able to do art and be in positions of power in the art scene matters. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I felt so much more confidence going into this production than I did the first time around. And I think it paid off because people have told me, like, you know, the show is even funnier than the first time. It's even more crazy than the first time, you know? And I took a lot more liberties with the writing and with the way that the story is being told. And I trusted my instincts, and I'm glad that I did. And I think that more people need the opportunity to do that, you know? And I'm really lucky that I'm in a position here at Oasis to be able to do that. But yeah, people need those opportunities, because if I didn't just take it and seize it, like, who knows? Maybe I wouldn't have felt confident enough to do it, and someone else maybe wouldn't have given me the opportunity.
And it's okay, too, I think, as artists to grow. Like you said, you know, the show's a little different than when you did it before. And sometimes, and Victoria, we were talking about, who's still in studio with me, we, you know, was talking about how many iterations of her play. Like, sometimes it takes time, and things can grow, and the world shifts. And so maybe that what you created shifts, too. And, yeah. And so, yeah, as the kids say, let it cook.
Yeah. And it's hard, right? It's hard because we have limited budgets. We have limited finances. So, like, we don't get the luxury of letting things cook in the way that they deserve sometimes. Yeah. And letting people explore and try stuff, right? Because there's always this kind of pressure that, like, it's got to be successful. It's got to make money. It's got to, you know, hit this, that, and the other goals. And, you know, obviously that is the bottom line for a lot of theater. But it's really special when you get the opportunity to try stuff.
Yeah.
And to just, like, have fun and not feel that weight on you at all times, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and having that pressure to hit it out the ballpark the first time. Mm-hmm. Snacks, you say in your bio is funny, that you are basically, quote, basically part of the furniture at Oasis, end quote. You're the COO of Oasis. You're head of costumes for the Golden Girls Live, which I saw in December, and the costumes were gorgeous. I had contacted Dorsey, and I said, you look so cute. Darcy. And I said, you look so cute, because he played Rose.
Yes.
And I loved his outfit, so it was nice to actually meet the person behind that. So I appreciate your work, too, in costumes. And the Golden Girls Live was another drag parody. So do you prefer working on stage or behind the scenes? Because you're also a drag queen.
You know, I go back and forth. Sometimes I really miss being on stage. And then I'm on stage and I'm like, I don't want to do this. I just want to work backstage.
Yeah.
And there's something really nice about when you're directing a show and you're able to have it be up and then walk away from it, you know, and not have to be there for every iteration of it.
Yeah. I know. I'm so used to, like, being in front. So and my producer, Porfirio Rangel, who's on with us, I'm sure he can relate to preferring being behind the scenes. So this is a popular show, and, like, this is not the first time it's been on stage. So what do audiences say they like about your version of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air?
I mean, the biggest compliment is that people think it's really funny. And it makes me happy because there are a lot of jokes that we've added, both that I've added in writing, the, like, putting the material together, and in the cast, you know. I mean, we do pull from real episodes and use most of the material that is already in the episode, mm-hmm. but we add some other stuff, add some more, like, you know, current, you know, jokes and stuff like that. And so there are some updates that we've made that people seem to really like. And so that's exciting. But I will say, you know, this show has been a struggle to sell in a way that other shows that we've been doing at Oasis recently has not.
Really?
And the reason I don't want to chalk everything up to racism. However, mm-hmm. I've heard people say, people that have not attended the show say, oh, that's not for me, or I don't know the material, or I this, that, the other. And I haven't heard that same kind of feedback for some of the other shows that we've done. And so it's interesting to me to reflect on the way that black art and black productions are received by the community. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because I did have to work harder. And I'll be honest, like, we get a lot of, you know, I send out a lot of press releases for a lot of the shows that we're doing, and I got very little engagement about Fresh Prince. And I don't know if it's just that people are like, that's not for me, that's not my kind of show, or, like, what exactly is going on there. But it's made me have to work even harder. And it makes me that much more proud of the show and that much more proud of all the actors for all of their contributions. But it has been a little bit of a challenging sell, and it's been interesting to kind of investigate what that's about and why.
That's disappointing, especially because that was such a huge show, you know, back in the day, and so many people of different races watched it. So that's, you know, disappointing that you're hitting those challenges. I heard about the show because Peaches Christ, I follow Peaches Christ, and Peaches Christ had posted about it. And I was like, I didn't know about that. And I was like, let me bring them on, you know, to the show. So I encourage folks, go check it out. Even if it's, you know, even if you don't know what The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is, it's a great comedy. And like I said, when I was growing up, everybody was watching that show. It felt like everybody was watching that show.
Totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, and I do just want to shout out that allyship, because Peaches, Sister Roma, Darcy, who owns the club, of course, there have been a lot of white people in the community that have really, like, come to bat for the show and really, yeah, like, helped me get the word out. And it's figures in the community that people trust. And so I'm really grateful to those people for helping plug the show, because that is the best way to get the word out, right, is by word of mouth. And people trust these figures. And so for them to be able to support me and say, hey, we're going to help get the word out about your show, like, that doesn't go unnoticed. And especially, you know, the show premiered during Black History Month. Like, mm-hmm, that should have been a no-brainer for people to come to the show. And so, again, I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of people that have been really supportive, and that is necessary still. And it's not, you know, it's not time to be latent about Black art and supporting Black artists and performers. Like, we have to be active and vigilant in the same way that we, you know, that doesn't go away.
Yeah. And as I was saying earlier, you know, I went to a play about MSG and Asian American cuisine and Japanese culture, and I had a good time. So I know for me, like, I step outside my community and consume art. I just love all different types of art. So I hope people get past their own barriers and go experience something different and do something fun and laugh, especially now with everything going on. Like, go laugh, have a skate, go back to the 90s. I mean, I think that's another perk for the show, is that you can kind of mentally just step back into the 90s with things that are more simple. Even I heard you made some jokes about today. I heard that, you know, what's going on currently. I heard that that's what's in the show too. But at least you kind of have a little mental escape. So before we wrap up real quick, what episodes are you doing real quick?
So we're doing the first episode, the first act of the show is two episodes mashed up. One is the one where Ashley is dealing with a bully at school. And then the other one is where Hillary has dropped out of school and the boys are making her do. It's a very, like, famous scene from the dinner table where, like, mm-hmm, Hillary's barking every time they say Hillary and, like, that kind of thing. So those two episodes make up the first act. And then the second act is Will graduating and needing to be in the kids' class and perform at the recital in order to graduate. So you get to see Will in the sunflower head.
I remember that.
You do. Yeah. It's very, very funny. So yeah, those are the episodes that we're mashing up to do this.
Well, Snacks, congratulations on the show. I hope people hear this and they go and have fun and laugh, because I know that show is funny. I've heard good things about it. Congratulations, and thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you having this platform, and thank you for having me on.
Yes, and come back, Snacks. Absolutely. All right, Snacks is the director of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air Live. The show runs this Thursday through Saturday at Oasis in San Francisco, and you can get your tickets on the Oasis website. And also this weekend, join me for Soul Tether Revival, a homecoming with Michael Ross and friends. Artist Michael Ross is traveling here from Florida for this event, and I'll be in conversation with him, along with visual artists Awan Mance and Nancy Cato. We're going to talk about literature, art, friendship, and San Francisco's Black LGBTQ+ arts community over the decades. Writer Jerry Thompson curated this gathering as part of a project with Small Press Traffic, and the event is this Saturday, 7 p.m. at Et Al Gallery in the San Francisco Mission. And if you can't make it in person, you can stream it, but I'd love to see you in person. And we'll have a link with more info on Sights and Sounds webpage. And that's all the time we have for my very first episode of the Sights and Sounds Show with Janae Darton. Thank you to our show producer, Porfirio Rangel, board operator, Damian Miner, and our director of audio programming, David Boyer. And thank you so much for tuning in. Next week, the San Francisco Ballet stops by to talk about their Frankenstein show. We'll also have an author who wrote a book about Nichelle Nichols. So I hope my Trekkies come through and listen. And yeah, we'll have another great show for you right here next Wednesday, 4 p.m. on KALW. Da-da-da, I had to get that out. All right, this is live, folks. That's why I'm stumbling. And until then, be good to yourselves and each other. I'm going to go home, put on my moo-moo, drink some tea, and relax.